Mr. Innes, Reel 2. You joined the Merchant Navy. What date was this?
Would be 1940.
So the war had started?
The war started, yes.
Before we come to that now, then, so you were working at Doxford through that period leading up to the war.
That's correct.
What signs of war coming were you seeing?
Well, they were starting to build the area shelters. They were issuing them. Conscription had started. And this is another point here. I was called up for registration, being 21. All 21s had to register for national service. I reported through to Newcastle for a medical. Checked OK. Then they used to ask you what service you wanted to go into. The reason for this, there's no pressed men in the Navy. So you volunteered. So I said, I want to go in the Navy. They said, right over. Took all my details. And they told me, you must not change your occupation. Well, I forgot all about that. So I went into the Merchant Navy. But if I'd fought my case, they would have probably let me stay in the Merchant Navy. But I thought to myself, I got calling up papers, you see. So I thought, well, it's on a safer bet in the Royal Navy. You can hit back. You've got some defence. So I thought, right, I'll go in there. So I went into the Royal Navy.
So the shelters were being built, as you say. Had gas masks been issued prior to the war?
Yes. I think I've got the tin in the garage there, the old round tin they were in. Yes, they were being issued.
And were sandbags going around public buildings or that kind of thing?
I can't recall that. No, I can't recall that.
Do you recall what you were doing at the time that announcement was made on that Sunday, when Chamberlain made the announcement?
I think I was in the house, listening to the radio. I had a radio when it came over. And I think the people downstairs, the house was still tenanted then, they came up because they didn't own a radio to hear the news, you know. And the man downstairs and his wife was a fella called Heslop, Charles Heslop.
It must have recalled bad memories for people who'd lived through the First World War to have war starting again.
Yes. Now the chap on the other side, and an old gentleman there, he'd been in the First World War and he was really worried. I used to talk to him occasionally and he says, oh, we'll all be killed tomorrow, you know, the bombs. He never experienced bombing, and he says, I've got these big bombs that blow everything up. You know, he was really a bit worried.
How did your parents feel? Because you were of an age where you would be involved in the war.
Yes. Well, to my knowledge, they didn't show any concern at all. They never impeded me in any way when I said I want to go into the Navy. They accepted it. They said, well, they didn't say, well, you've got a good, safe job. You're a printer. But eventually I would have been called up. And I would have probably ended up in the Army. Well, being in the engineering profession, the Navy, they were requiring artificers and likes of that. So it worked for the best, really.
Were the changes to your lifestyle, you might say, that when the war started, did that bring changes in your job and your work? And
not really, not in the shipyard. Everything went on the same. And another thing, in the shipyard, I was never singled out for any perks that were going. I never got any overtime. Other apprentices did, you see. It didn't bother me at all. And when the ships went out on trials, I never got out with the trial crews. Till one chargeman, a fella called, what was his name, Hill, he said to me, he says, you've never been on one of these trials, why is that? I said, I don't know, I never get asked. He said, right, you're on the next one with me, you see. And that was the first trial I got, but some of the other boys had had two or three, because ships were being produced fairly quickly, you know, they were speeding up with the war.
What ships were they producing engines for?
Cargo ships, tramp ships mainly. In fact, when I started at Doxford's, it was the start of the end of the Depression. Because when I went into the fitting shops, one of the old fitters there, he said to me, he says, "You're making a bad mistake coming in here." He says, "This business," he says, "the work never lasts. You'll be on the door, you'll never do anything." He said, "You want to get out." How wrong he was. You see, went the other way. I've never been out of work in my life. But that's the way it was pre-year. They built a ship, no work, paid off till the next order. But from then on, it was continuous. There was no let up.
And they continued providing engines for tramps, merchant vessels.
That's right.
You didn't go on to naval vessels.
No. I think they did at the latter end of the war, but not while I was there. Because Doxford, I don't know whether you know the history of this company, they were pioneers in the solid injection fuel diesels. Prior to that, the first motor ship I actually went on was blast injection. And Doxford pioneered this, and they had an awful job, because in those days, there was no standard fuel. You could go in one place, you got fuel which was highly potent, dangerous stuff. The result was, when Doxford was building these engines, they were having trouble with pistons being burnt through, this, that and the other. But once they brought a standardised fuel in, Doxford was made. And that engine took off, was built under licence in practically every maritime country in the world, took up the Doxford licence. Today that engine's gone. Solely for the simple reason, as the big ships came in, they still kept producing for the small ship. Then the problem arose, they were all big ships. Doxford didn't have an engine. So in that haste, they produced an engine, the P engine, which was a disaster. So then they've said, well, that's no good. They produced another one, the J type. Another disaster. Now, ship owners are getting wary now. So in the end, they went in conjunction with Hawthorne Leslie and produced another engine called the Seahorse. There's not one order placed for that engine. Nobody would touch them. After two previous disasters, so the Doxford engine went, and it was a world leader. It was said that at no time was there less than 1,000 Doxford engine ships at sea when they were in that peak. No, there's not.
The actual process of joining the Merchant Navy, I know you were recommended, or at least this chap asked you to go to his place. What was the actual process of joining the Merchant Navy?
Well, it was very simple then. I wrote the company, and the company told me to go to the pool. There was a shipping pool organised then, and they gave me authorisation to go. And I got a registered number, R208291. That was my Merchant Navy number. And that was it. I was issued with a discharge book, and away you went. I didn't have a medical, to my knowledge. If you walked, you were all right kind of business. Because the war was on.
I was going to say, the war was on, and merchant ships were being sunk then, weren't
That's
they?
That's right.
And that didn't deter you in any way, that you were going to a very dangerous job.
But I'll tell you something else, which will crop up later. Before I went to sea, I used to get these dreams of a ship being sunk, being torpedoed, water rushing in, and all this. And occasionally these cropped up, till when it actually happened, I never got there anymore. What do you know? Funny.
Where did you join the ship?
In Barry, in Wales.
And what exactly were you becoming on the ship? What was your job?
I was the fifth engineer. Now, that decision is made by the second engineer. He decides, three junior engineers, fifth, sixth and seventh. They assist the second, third and fourth, who were the main watchkeepers. So the second engineer, he took a liking to me. He says, right, you were on with me, you were the fifth engineer. And the other lad, the sixth, he was one of these voluntary airmen, trained to be one of these voluntary groups, and he could fly a plane. But when the ship docked after our first voyage, they were waiting for him, and he was whipped away into the RAF. He'd be one of the first of the few, that boy. I can't remember his name now. So whether he survived the war, I don't know.
Who owned the ship?
Furness Holder.
Could you tell me, give me its dimensions and its tonnage and so forth?
I've got a photograph of the ship. Tonnage, I think about 15,000 ton. Built in 1918. Twin screw, triple expansion. Refrigerated. Carried frozen meat from the Argentine to the UK, which was a big trade in those days. I think we could, fully equipped up with crew and passenger, would carry about 100. Because we had a doctor, and I think you had to have 100 to have a doctor aboard, if I remember right. I think that was it. Duquesa was the name of the ship. There was three. There was the Baronessa, Duquesa and Marquesa. As Furness Holder, they had several other companies there, different names, you know. That was Furness Holder Argentine, and there was Furness Holder and Furness Shipping, different groups. You know.
So, and you could carry passengers there?
Yes. I think it was about 12, wasn't many.
And the captain of the vessel, do you remember his name?
I think it was Bear Park. I'm trying to think of the second engineer's name and the chief engineer, but they were both elderly people, and I don't think they would survive the prison camp. They'd be in their 60s, and they'd be interned for 5 years, you know.
Now, your own work, in common parlance, we talk about shifts, you work shifts. You work watches, I think it was.
Watches, yes.
How were they divided during the day?
Well, the second engineer always does the 4-8 watch. The fourth engineer does the 8-12. That's classed as the chief engineer's watch, but he doesn't keep a watch. The fourth engineer keeps the watch for him. Chief engineer usually goes down, got his convenient times, 8-12 his watch. He's generally awake. He can go down and see everything's all right and so forth. And the third engineer, he keeps the 12-4, middle watch. But in the Navy, it's a different routine.
Yes, we were talking about the Merchant Navy Anthem at the moment. Can you tell me what conditions were like in the engine room of your merchant vessel?
Well, they were quite good for the time. So it was a 1918 ship, and one of the main problems was had a big refrigerating plant, steam driven. And there was always arguments between the second engineer and the chief refrigerating engineer. He keep taking more steam away, because slowed the ship down, you see, and there used to be arguments, you're taking more, and blah, 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 blah. But I know we used to burn about 100-odd ton of coal a day, which is coal burning. We had five men on watch in the stokehold. There was four boilers, and one man, trimmer, who used to wheel the coal up to the furnaces, you know.
And they would be putting the fuel into the, or the coal into the boilers, fires.
And
were they called stokers in the Merchant Navy as
firemen.
Well? Firemen.
Firemen. Uh-huh. And the leading fireman who sets the pace when the fire, when the rake, when the slice, at various operations in the burning of the fuel, he's called the stokehold bosun. He bangs the shovel in the start. They say, right, fire, you know, nowhere to go.
They must have been not the best of conditions to work in.
No, but they were quite cheerful. They used to be singing away, you know, because it used to annoy the passengers, because the noise used to go up the ventilators. They'd be singing, sometimes not very pop. And the second engineer and the chief used to get hauled over the coal, trying not to control the men down there.
The conditions in which you were working under, what were they like?
Quite good. I had my own cabin. Down below, it was quite in the tropics. There was no fans. It was all natural ventilation. You had to keep going up deck to turn the vent into the wind to get some air down below. Quite hot. But everybody worked together. It was quite a jovial setup. Even the firemen, you know, they were a happy crowd. But you see, when you go into port, when you sailed, you probably had different firemen. A lot of them didn't turn up, so they went the nearest pool, but Sean got extra men that missed the last ships, and so it went on.
Now your own particular work in the engine room, what was it that you were doing?
Well, mainly watchkeeping duties. I mean, steam engines are pretty reliable. You kept a log every watch, you know, end of the watch, kept revolutions and telegraph movements, logged all this. And in port, you did any maintenance work required. But a steam engine's known for its reliability, you know, they just sort of wear all the time, very reliable. Not like diesels where all kinds of things happen. Not so today, of course, but in the early days.
And in spite of its age, it was a reliable vessel.
Oh, yes, very good. Do about 15 knots. And when we went out, we used to take 3,000 extra ton of coal into the refrigerated rooms down below. But when you got the other end, you burnt that coal first. So when you got down to the BA, the loading ports, that room was cleaned out of coal. And they came in, cleaned it out, and meat went into there. Then you had enough coal in your standard bunkers to get you to Freetown, where your coal ship again was all done manually by bags up the side of the ship in steps. And a man on the deck counting each bag that went down the hatch could count to 10. One bag go, two bag go, three bag, then tally go, that was 10. And he put a mark on the board, a native, you see. And that's how the coal was checked in. And that got you back, was discharged in France. We were under air attack then, it was getting near Dunkirk, you see. And a firebomb went through one of the hatches, but it didn't burn. Landed on coal, I think, and they got it out. But other than that, it was all right. Then we came back to, I think, Liverpool were discharged, and I paid off, came home.
Were you issued with a uniform in the Merchant Navy?
No, you bought your own.
And what was that?
Well, it consisted... I've got a picture there. Well, that's up there, really. But at any rate, just a jacket, trousers, cap, badge. And you could buy a company's badge, but I bought the standard Merchant Navy badge. But I think some companies, British tankers, incidentally, prior to going to do Kessa, I'd applied to British tankers for a job. And I had to go through to Newcastle for a medical. Rye Hill, I think the medical place was. And the doctor there turned me down as medically unfit. Medically unfit. I made a deal. And I went into the Navy medically fit. So that was British tankers. Now, they issued uniforms, I understand, and overalls.
But so it was a general uniform, not a company uniform?
No, it was a general uniform. There's only the cap badge related to the company. Yeah, the standard uniform, standard braid. Yes.
And you sailed initially from where?
Barrie.
And over to... You were going to where? Argentina, was it?
Yeah, Argentina. Buenos Aires, the first port.
Did you go over empty?
Yes. Just with this 3,000 extra ton for to get you back, you know.
Did she sail pretty well through various seas?
Oh, yes. No problems. Good sea ship.
And you yourself, did you suffer from seasickness?
I did, but not on that vessel. On later ones, very badly. Yeah.
Could you swim, by the way?
Not then. In the Navy, I could. Because they taught you there.
And were you sailing in convoy? Because this was wartime.
No convoy. I think at that particular time, if you did 15 knots, they considered you safe from submarine attack. Because submarines weren't quite as fast. They're very fast now, but they weren't then. So you were considered reasonably safe. Convoys were slow.
So you were a single vessel?
Single vessel.
Journey.
That's how she was in contact. She was picked up by an armed raider.
Do you recall the date that you first left on this voyage?
I've got this thing on. I was going to say, I've got it wrote down. My mother wrote it down on the back of an old board there.
From 1940 or something.
I think it was. I think it was December when I went into the Navy. Yes, I think it was December, the Navy. I'd have to check that.
Anyway, you sailed on this NP vessel to Buenos Aires, I think you said. And it was an uneventful journey, presumably.
That's right. Yeah.
How long did it take?
I think it took about 20-odd days.
And in those days, did you have to have a constant lookout for submarines?
Yes, there was the war standards was applying then, you know. But later on, I think they developed a more efficient system, the BAM system, I think they called it.
And what was that, do you know?
Well, that certain areas of the Atlantic marked off in squares, and they knew where these subs were operating from the number of sinkings. They would say that area's dangerous, use area, so it's what it is, trying to avoid them.
Was it armed, the vessel? Did you have a gun on it?
No. I think we had a wooden one, I'm not quite sure. But we had no gunners. Be a wooden gun. Aft. Because legally, you couldn't enter port if you had a gun forward. It classed as a warship. So you had to have no forward gun. We'd go into neutral ports. But you allowed one aft. Funny that.
And that was a dummy, in effect. Dummy gun.
Dummy, yes. There was quite a few ships fitted with them, apparently. So there wasn't the guns to equip all these ships, you know. They were caught unawares. But really they shouldn't. They knew Germany was arming them long before. But nothing was done to get this country rearmed.
Were you excited going to sea and going to foreign lands, foreign parts?
I was, yes. And what amazed me was how advanced. I always thought they were running around in naked and all this. You go to places like Buenos Aires, we go on the main street, 17 mile long without a bend, and there's 6-lane traffic. See, who's backward here? But whoever planned that city out, and some of them American cities in the south, had great foresight.
What were your impressions of the civilian people that you met for the first time over there?
Well, very good. I never met any hostility. No racism, whatever you call it now. There was none of that. Everybody was just accepted. You went into these bars and places. They just seemed to take no notice of you. It was just one of them kind of business. You know, colour didn't matter. The only difference you found in America at that particular time, if you went into a black area and you spoke to them, they thought you were unusual. Because the American whites weren't that sociable to them. Because I remember going into this place, and it was a native band playing, and we went up after they'd played and we thanked them, you know, for the music. That was great, that, you know. And they were highly delighted because we were in uniform service. And we were speaking to them, and they said, oh, did you know this person? These American, forget their names now, top American jazz players. Oh, and you were there. And they were asking us about our top band men and the tunes at the time and one. I'm trying to think what it was. It was very popular here. And they had never heard of it, you know. So this fella, I don't know who he was, he says, oh, I'll hum it for you. And he was humming it. They were trying to pick it up. I forget what it was now. Oh, never mind.
So when you arrived at Buenos Aires, what the cargo were you taking on?
Meat. I think it was mainly meat, beef. I don't think there was any lamb being shipped. I think it was all beef. Because the dockers, at lunchtime, they used to have a spit rigged up on the dock side, and they'd roast an hour lamb or something. And where you could go down, they'd give you a lump of meat off it. They did all this on the dock side.
And were you involved in supervising that lading of
no,
cargo?
No, nothing to do with that. No.
You were engine room?
Engine room and lighting on the deck if lights went, you know, when they're working at night. Carried no electricians in those ships in those days. do now.
Did you have working for you in the engine room people who cleaned and polished and...
Oh, yes. Greasers. Donkey greasers. They looked after the donkey boiler and did greasing as well.
So your particular task was just checking and supervising and seeing everything was okay.
That's right. Under the supervision of the second engineer in charge of the watch.
And then you had these working sailors who you say...
I tell you an interesting point here, which I don't think it's done today. But when you go on watch, the watch starts at 1 bell. That's the way it used to be. Now they probably don't go down to 8 bells. But we used to get out 1 bell at the top of the engine room. You'd have the donkey greasers lined up. And when 1 bell struck, we all went down. The engineers went down first, two of us. Then the donkey greasers. Now they used to go right round the engine, check everything, along the tail end shaft, check the bearings and all that along the shaft tunnels. Then come back. Then report to the second engineer everything okay. That released the previous watch. If there was any trouble, like a hot bearing down the shaft tunnel, the engineer and the bloke in charge had to stop down there till they got that cooled down before the next watch would take over. That was the routine then. But it's not so now. I saw this deterioration over the years because I spent 33 years at sea and I saw the standards going all the time, like everything else. Everything went down. But that's the way it was then, very highly efficient. And there was nobody late for watch. They were always there. Same routine, in and out. Watch relieved, the old watch went off.
They're pretty strict and well-disciplined crew.
They were then, yeah. In ports, a different story, mind. With a drink, you know, and getting on the turn too. You had problems there. But I've seen some remarkable cases there where you get... Two brothers, Halligan brothers, from Liverpool. One was an alcoholic. His other brother used to do his watch. Kept him under control. He came aboard, go down. I said, where's Tommy? Oh, he's not too well. I'll do his watch. That's the way they were. Always sailed together. One looked after him all the time. Amazing, isn't it?
The work of these donkey greasers, you call them, people, was that a constant job, going round
oiling
and greasing all the time?
Yeah, yeah. Cleaning, do cleaning work, you know, after the night I do the polish handrails, you know, general work.
And you had no major problems with the engines whilst you were on the ship?
Oh, no. Because they're under survey, you know, and when you did survey work, you had to open up bearings, lift pistons and all that. Then the firemen and everybody assisted to get them out. Then Lloyd's surveyor came, examined it, passed it, and you put it back.